From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Yousef Salam describes living through the nightmare of being falsely accused and imprisoned for a brutal crime he had nothing to do with. In 1990, he was one of four teenagers convicted in the so-called Central Park jogger case. Long after he'd served a seven-year prison sentence, DNA evidence confirmed that a serial rapist and murderer had committed the crime and acted alone. Salam has a new memoir reflecting on his experience. Also, reckoning with the history of slavery across America. In his new book, Clint Smith visits eight places central to the history of slavery, including Thomas Jefferson's plantation Monticello and a cemetery where 30,000 Confederate soldiers are buried. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album, Black to the Future, by the British jazz quartet Sons of Kemet.
What happens to police officers who get caught stealing, lying, or tampering with evidence? Each week, we open up an internal affairs investigation that used to be secret to find out how well the police police themselves. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Fresh Air's Dave Davies has today's first interview. Here he is to introduce it.
You may recognize the name of our guest, Yousef Salam, but you've almost certainly heard of the event that turned his life upside down. He's one of five teenaged boys who were arrested and convicted in 1989 of the brutal assault and rape of a woman in New York, the so-called Central Park jogger case. Police extracted confessions from four of the five accused, all of whom recanted those confessions, saying they were coerced by police. Despite a lack of physical evidence linking them to the crime, they were convicted by a jury and spent years in prison. But in 2002, DNA evidence confirmed that the assault was committed by a serial rapist who confessed to acting alone in the crime and who gave police critical details corroborating his account. The convictions were vacated, and Yousef Salam now refers to himself, Antron McRae, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, and Corey Wise as the Exonerated Five. Their stories were told in a 2012 documentary by Ken Burns and more recently dramatized in the Netflix series When They See Us, directed by Ava DuVernay. Yousef Salam earned his GED while incarcerated and also earned an associate's degree from Dutchess Community College. He later continued his education at Hunter College and in 2016 received a Lifetime Achievement Award from President Obama. He's currently a motivational speaker and serves on the board of the Innocence Project. And he's written a new memoir reflecting on his experience. It's called Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. He joins us from his home in the Atlanta area. Yousef Salam, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about your story, and I want to kind of begin by talking about the time after you were released from prison, because I think, you know, a lot of people know your story but don't know the whole story. And I think there's a common belief that what happened was that you were wrongly convicted, sent to prison. And then after some years, when the true identity of the attacker was revealed, you and your four co-defendants were released and you entered the world as free men known to all to have been the victim of this injustice. That's not the sequence, is it?
It is not. It definitely did not happen that way. Maybe for Corey, because Corey was in prison and came out of prison as a result of the real perpetrator telling the truth about his crime.
He was in longer than you were and the others, yeah.
Yeah, he was in there from 1989 all the way to and through 2002. And so when the real truth came out, that's when we got our lives back. But for those of us who had 5 to 10 years prison sentences, we had done all of someone else's time. We had done all of someone else's parole time. And we were, in many ways, resigned in life that we will be forever known as pariahs, as the scum of the earth, as the members of a group called the Central Park Five, who we knew were wrongly accused, but the rest of the world believed that we were actually guilty of the crime and did the time.
Right. So I want to talk a bit about that five-year period when you were out, but had this incredible stigma and burden on you. You know, you missed the part of your life from roughly age 16 to 23, right? And that's a time when, you know, you go through adolescence and you learn about romance and infatuation and how to talk to people you're attracted to, and you get through your first heartbreak, and you come and you're 23 years old, and You didn't have all that. You were incarcerated during that time, and then you have this whole thing. What was it like meeting people and talking? You described meeting a woman who you were interested in. I mean, then you had this secret. How did you deal with it? How do you know when to tell people? How to tell them?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's like living life on eggshells, constantly trying not to break any eggshell, constantly being careful, definitely being hypervigilant of all situations. So those things that you would see portrayed in the news or portrayed in television and definitely on movies where you see people having a romantic evening, gazing into each other's eyes, walking down the boardwalk, holding hands. I never did anything like that. That was perhaps one of the most scariest moments for me, because in the vulnerability of what love, the possibility of love, you always say to yourself, what if? You know, and so you're always looking around. And in many ways, that gives the person who you're with this feeling of uncomfortability. And it's not that you're even aware that you're making them uncomfortable either. You're just so aware of your surroundings because of the unfortunate circumstance of prison and surviving prison that you've just come through. And really, in many ways, that you'd never get over.
You spent a lot of time on parole. What were some of the most burdensome conditions? What was hard about that?
Oh, wow. The most difficult thing about being on parole is that when you're on parole, you have a curfew. And here you are, a grown man, and people who you're back in the neighborhood with, they're hanging out on the weekends. They're doing things that people do normally in normal society. And you have to come back home and be home similar to what we were experiencing as children. As soon as the lights came on, you had to be home. And, you know, that was a difficult thing, especially if you worked and the only jobs that you could find because of the conditions of your case. And by conditions, I'm really talking about something that people don't really always know, that when you come home from prison, you have to tell the employer that you were convicted of a crime. And in our case, it was the Central Park jogger case. And who would give us a job? But for those individuals that were lenient towards us and, you know, felt a little bit of compassion, sometimes they would give us jobs, and those jobs would be overnight shifts. You know, and so sometimes our parole officers would not want us to be out past those times. And so it was a bit of a challenge in that regard.
Did you have to go to classes for sex offenders? I mean, you were a convicted sex offender, even though you hadn't done it.
Yeah. You know, coming home from prison, one of the conditions of parole was that you had to get therapy. You know, we were not just convicted sex offenders, but they had listed us after the Megan's Law. They had listed us as level 3 sex offenders. That meant that we were sexual predators. I mean, can you imagine the word and what that conjures up, a predator? You know, that's just one of the most despicable and disgusting ideas that you can ever think of. Of course, we were always kicked out of those sessions, similar to the sessions that we were kicked out of in prison, because we had never, as a condition of that part of the process, agreed to, okay, well, tell us about the crime, the accountability of it all. What did you do and why did you do it?
That was part of the therapy, is that you acknowledging and taking responsibility for your crime, right?
Yes, it was.
And so if you're a therapist employed in this process and you're part of the legal system, you know, legally the finder of fact is the jury, and the jury found you guilty. Therefore, in their minds, you are factually guilty. So when you would get into this, what would happen? Would they just tell you you got to leave, or?
Yeah, it would be a struggle, but it was a mental struggle. It was a war on me knowing that I could stand my ground before I really knew what stand your ground was, and being able to stand on that square with conviction and know that I didn't do this, and be able to be willing to go toe-to-toe, be willing to fight for that truth. And oftentimes the therapist would succumb and say, you know, you can leave. You know, it was one of those things I'll never forget. A few times I would be there and maybe one or two of the members of the Exonerated Five would be there. And, you know, I remember with some of us, if we didn't come out at the same time and we came out a little later, those of us who got our sea legs already were able to fend for the ones who didn't. And it kicked us all out.
Yousef Salaam's new memoir is Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new Sons of Kemet album, Black to the Future. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
Our guest, Yousef Salaam, is one of five African-American and Latino men who were convicted as teenagers in the so-called Central Park Jogger case, and later exonerated when DNA evidence confirmed the confession of a serial rapist who said he'd committed the crime alone. Salaam has a new memoir called Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. So I want to talk a bit about the events in 1989 and 1990, the arrest, the questioning, being taken to the police station. You say in the book that you actually went looking for the police because you heard they were looking for you. Your attitude was, I'm prepared to help you.
Yeah, it's the strangest thing. You know, knowing what I know now, how can you help a system that sees you as a crime, sees you as guilty? You know, a system that tells you very, very clearly through the Miranda warnings, you have the right to remain silent. But when we watch TV, we know that what do they usually tell you? And they told us as well inside the interrogation room. You know, only guilty people remain silent. You can talk to us. But then part two is what? Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Now, mind you, we weren't told our Miranda warnings before questioning. As a matter of fact, I never forget when they finished questioning me, they took this card, slid it across the table, and told me to sign it. I didn't even read what it was that I was signing.
Was it a blank card or did it have
It had writing on it. And that was what they were supposed to give me, meaning they were supposed to say to me, do you understand your rights? They were supposed to tell me each of these rights, and they did not do this.
Did you sign the card?
I signed the card. Mm. They presented that card at trial.
How long were you held and questioned?
Wow, the initial questioning period, it was one of those moments where you can't remember time. I remember coming in the evening, how many hours passed. I just remember in the morning we were taken from one precinct to the next. And so you can imagine if that happened at sundown, if they picked me up and it was, say, 7 p.m., 8 p.m., all the way to and through the next morning. Whereas Raymond Santana and Kevin Richardson had been arrested that night. So we were arrested, myself and Corey, on the 20th of April. And Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana were arrested on April 19th of 1989. They had been interrogated since they were arrested.
So in some cases, 24 hours or more for these guys.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Okay. You know, this is a case where if I have this right, four of the five of you, everyone but you gave detailed confessions to participating in a crime that they had nothing to do with. You did not, right?
That is correct.
Right.
That is correct.
And, you know, a lot of people just have a hard time understanding why anyone would ever confess to a crime with a made-up story that put them in the middle of this horrible act that they had nothing to do with it. Why would you ever, under any circumstance, agree to this made-up story? Can you help us understand how that happened to these guys?
You know, as I see it, in this made-up story, these false narratives, right, that became part of this false confession, I remember when I was there with Corey, hearing him getting beat up in the next room. And I remember hearing him yell out, okay, okay, I'll tell you. And he made, if I'm not mistaken, four completely different confessions. Four completely different ones. And the one that he implicated me in, they played at my trial. And all we wanted to do was go home. This was a nightmare. We were delirious with hunger. We were delirious, because time was passing and we didn't know what time it was. You know, just a whole nightmare of the whole situation. And I think what happens is after a certain point, you break. And in The Breaking Point, you say anything that will allow you to get out of that. I remember listening to Ramos Santana's confession, his false confession, and he accurately described this process in such a powerful way, where he said, they gave me the options. They showed him a photograph and said, this woman was beaten very badly. She had to be beaten with something. What was she beaten with? And he didn't know because he wasn't there. And they said, come on, it had to be a brick, a rock, or a pipe. They gave him the options. I remember hearing his false confession at trial, and it was the most craziest thing that people believed in 1989. Here he is being made to say, at approximately 1900 hours, me and a group of my colleagues began to walk south. Now, the wording might not be exactly that, but it's something that's so outrageous.
Not something a teenager would ever say, right? Right, right.
Right, and he looks up. He looks up in the documentary, The Central Park Five, and says, what 14-year-old boy talks like that? And I remember being in the movie theaters while people were watching that scene in particular. And the gasp, the audible gasp that you heard in the room was as if they had, for the first time, revealed that they had been tricked.
You mentioned that everybody wanted to go home. Were you told, tell us the story and you can go home?
I was. And every time I told the story, every time I told everything that I knew about the events that night, they kept saying, was this when the jogger? Was this when you got the jogger? Was that when you got the jogger? And I didn't know anything about a jogger, so I couldn't say yes or no. I said, I don't know anything about a jogger. I'm telling you what I saw.
Did you ever, in your despair, make up a story as the others did? Or let's say, adopt the story that had been suggested that you participated in this attack?
I did not.
Okay, so you hung on. And then your mom eventually showed up, right, and said, you can't be talking to him.
Yeah. She told me something that's very important, and I think that the thing that she told me is something that I tell people often. She said to me, stop talking to them. And then she said to me, they need you to participate in whatever it is that they're trying to do. Do not participate. Refuse. And for me, it was one of the most powerful learning tools that I could ever imagine, because here I was on my own being told to stand my ground. And being told in many ways that it's on me. I can't come into the room with you. I can't fight for you. You have to fight for yourself. But I need you to know that whatever you do, they're trying to get you to participate in your own destruction.
You know, one thing that people may not realize is that after the other four were talked into agreeing to the story about what happened, how they had participated and or observed in the Central Park joggers attack, they then did this on a videotape, and when these were played in court, they began not with them describing the things, but with the prosecutor, Elizabeth Lederer, calmly, patiently explaining to each of the kids, you have a right to remain silent. Do you understand? Yes. You have a right to an attorney. Do you understand that? Right. An attorney can be provided if you can't afford. You understand this? All of them agreeing, which I think lent so much more credibility, I guess, to the jury. Like, why would they say all that if it wasn't true?
In New York, one of the things that we fought for is for the whole of the custodial interrogation to be recorded. And the reason why we wanted that to be recorded is that in the Central Park jogger case, when the jury saw this false story being presented in front of their eyes in such a pretty package, wow, you have the prosecutor reading the Miranda warnings and you have these culprits agreeing. And then they tell this story. Now, mind you, the story is not factual in any way, form, or fashion. The forensic scientists know this. But yet, they went forward. They went forward and presented this in front of the jury. And the jury were made to believe that what they were seeing was true. That these false confessions were actually real confessions. You know, okay, well, maybe they got some of the stuff mixed up because maybe they didn't remember exactly where it happened, what happened, how it happened. But the forensic scientists had a photograph of a drag line. And in the drag line, there could not have been a gang rape.
This is where the jogger was dragged off the trail into the woods. And it's a very narrow line.
It's a very narrow line showing only the assailant and the victim.
Yeah, right. And if it were a gang rape, then a lot more grass would have been trampled, right?
Well, not only that, I think that had that photograph and had the descriptions been fair, like had we lived in a truly just society, then we would have been afforded the opportunity to have a proper defense mounted. The system would have said, well, this is what we found, and some of our findings are misleading, but then that would be the system working. The system is actually working exactly as it was imagined.
All that said, I mean, there were contradictions among the statements. There was, you know, no physical evidence tying any of you to it. You were offered a plea deal but didn't take it because you weren't going to admit to something that didn't happen. Did you think that the jury would render the verdict it did?
I didn't. I thought that the jury would see through all of the lies. Up until the last moment, I had tremendous hope. I was on bail. And I remember someone running up to me. I was on the phone with a friend of mine, and I remember someone running up to me. They got the verdict. And I told the person, hey, they got the verdict. I'll see you in a little while. I'll be right back. I'll be home. And I didn't come back until 7 years later.
You were immediately taken from the courtroom in cuffs. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to grasp it. When you went through, you know, the arrest and the trial and the conviction, you were 15, 16. And now when you come back and re-experience this, you're all young men in your 30s. And you've been dealing with this trauma through all these years. And you write in the book that there were times that you would have to do it through a kind of detachment, to think of this as happening to a third person named Yusuf. And you say you need to let the wounds scar over and eventually heal. Can you give us a sense of where you are in that journey today, healing from this?
Yeah. I think there's been a tremendous we've been able to make leaps and bounds in our healing, in our adjustments into society. But at the same time, it's still there, lurking in the background. You know, the awful experience that we should have never gone through is really always the cloud over our heads, right? But the cool thing about it is that we now know how to deal with those emotions. We now can say, this is how you get through any prison that you may be going through, whether you're physically in bondage or not, right? Making the choices that are meaningful, you know, taking the time to breathe, you know, meditating, creating vision boards, all of those things are necessary. You know, they say the imagination is the precursor of what's to come. And so if you can imagine a future that is brighter than the one that you're growing through, and I'm saying growing through on purpose, because when you get to that point, you realize that you're not just going through something, but that you're being prepared for greatness. That you need to know the lows in order to appreciate the highs in life. And I think that when I look at my story, you know, being able to look at it from the outside gives me the tremendous opportunity to describe in full what it is that I had gone through. And then going back in and being a participant in my growth and development is important, because you have to marry those two things together, you know, and it's that causes you to step forward with tremendous hope in the future, with tremendous faith in the future, knowing that it can only get better and not get worse.
Yusuf Salam, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yusuf Salam's new memoir is called Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the Black British jazz scene is going through a lively period lately, not least because of the efforts of London bandleader and reed player Shabaka Hutchings, whose bands include The Comet Is Coming and Shabaka and the Ancestors. For a decade, he's also led a quartet with tuba called Sons of Kemet. Kevin really likes their latest.
Thank you. the London quartet Sons of Kemet, with Theon Cross on tuba, drummers Tom Skinner and Edward Wakili Hick, and leader Shabaka Hutchings on saxophones and woodwinds. Their new album, Black to the Future, is very much a studio project. They laid down the basic tracks live, but with the pandemic and all, Hutchings had ample time to layer on more parts. He likes saxophone out front, with choral clarinets in the background. Also massed flutes, which can sound cotton candy fluffy, or backwoods ragged, or one and then the other. Sons of Kemet, sounding at the end there like a Black Mississippi fife and drum band. Leader Shabaka Hutchings was born in London, but partly raised in Barbados. He has a keen ear for the crisscrossing trajectories of African musical diasporas, West Africa to the Caribbean and the U.S., South Africa to the U.K., and the Caribbean to the U.S. and Europe. This social music reflects those deep connections, while vocalists on a few tracks offer perspectives on the realities of Black lives now.
These peace signs are just a piece of the puzzle. Spit to the muzzle, silence the lambs, kiss and they cuddle, forget that they cut you. It's just part of the hustle. Born from the mall where the hustle is sign. Born from the mall where the hustle is sign. Born from the mall where the hustle is sign. Born from the mall where the hustle is sign.
Rapper, poet Koji Radical, born from the mud with the hustle inside. On saxophone, Shabaka Hutchings may play a narrow range of pitches and staccato rhythm, like he's mimicking speech. On For the Culture, the London DJ D-Double-E meets him coming the other way, with echoes of half-sung, half-spoken Jamaican dancehall toasting.
To the wall, she made me nearly fool. She made me nearly look a fool. You gotta make a gal know. You gotta go with the flow and make her wind down low. And make her wind down low.
The double drummers bring their own island accents there. Sons of Kemet's guest helpers include some Americans. Poet Moore Mother and multi-talent Angel Bot Dawid sing on one number. And tenor saxophonist Kebby Williams joins in on one of those dense pieces built in layers called Envision Yourself Levitating. Those sonic layers and collisions reflect the many cultural strata and confrontations that inform Black British music, which both embraces and stands a little apart from various Black and British traditions. The music is carefully constructed, but Sons of Kemet can sound mysterious too, delving into the inexplicable. Among Shabaka Hutchings' several bands, Sons of Kemet stands out for me, not least due to Theon Cross's earth-shaking tuba. Tuba, with its own rich associations with early jazz, parades, and other social musics. Tuba helps bring out that ancient-to-the-future quality common to much black art music. And it's got that beat.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film, and he's the recipient of this year's Lifetime Achievement Award in Jazz Journalism from the Jazz Journalists Association. He reviewed Black to the Future, the new recording by the British jazz quartet Sons of Kemet. Coming up, Atlantic staff writer and poet Clint Smith talks about his new book, How the Word is Passed, a reckoning with the history of slavery across America. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision. Kind of like Taylor Swift choosing a cardigan on a chilly day. And with their top-rated app, you can deposit checks and transfer money anytime, anywhere, making Capital One an even easier decision. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
After the statue of Robert E. Lee near downtown New Orleans was taken down from its 60-foot pedestal in 2017, Clint Smith says he became obsessed with how slavery is remembered and reckoned with, and with teaching himself all the things he wishes someone had taught him long ago. Smith is from New Orleans, where at least 100 streets, statues, parks, and schools are named after Confederate figures, slaveholders, and defenders of slavery. The street his parents live on is named after a man who owned more than 150 enslaved people. In Smith's new book, he reports and reflects on his travels to 8 places to understand how each reckons with its relationship to the history of American slavery. The places he goes to include Thomas Jefferson's plantation, Monticello, the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana, where the enslaved people in that parish revolted, a cemetery in which 30,000 Confederate soldiers are buried, and Angola Prison, which is built on the site of a plantation. At the end of the book, Smith interviews his grandparents to see how this history has shaped his family. His grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. Clint Smith is a staff writer at The Atlantic. His book, Counting Descent, won the 2017 Literary Award for Best Poetry Book from the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. In 2014, he was the National Poetry Slam champion. His new book is called How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Clint Smith, welcome to our show. It's actually your second time on our show because you read a really excellent poem on our show a while ago during the pandemic about growing up in New Orleans where it seemed like all the streets were named after Confederate generals or people who had owned slaves. Tell us more about why you wanted to write about sites that were major places in the history of slavery, major sites of slavery.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be here. So much of what animated this book and served as a catalyst for wanting to write this book was watching the statues, these Confederate statues in my hometown of New Orleans, come down in May of 2017. And so statues of Robert E. Lee, P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, among other symbols of white supremacy, coming down after having been erected and located in different parts of the city for over a century, many of them. And I started thinking about what it meant that I grew up in a majority black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were enslaved people. Like, what did it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway. Plantations on field trips as an elementary and middle school student. I was going to places that were the sites of torture and intergenerational chattel bondage, but no one said the word slavery. And so I started thinking about like how that came to be because, you know, symbols aren't just symbols. They are reflective of stories that we tell. And those stories embed themselves into the narratives that a society carries. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy obviously shapes the material conditions of people's lives. And so the implications of this were vast. And so I started thinking about that in New Orleans. And then I kind of started thinking about, well, what did this look like across the country and across the ocean? Like, what are the different places that are attempting to or failing to tell a story about the history of slavery? And how does that shape our country's collective memory of this institution that we are told happened a long time ago, but in fact wasn't that long ago at all?
What were you taught in school about the Confederate generals and the owners of enslaved people whose names and statues were all over New Orleans where you grew up?
I was taught very little, to be honest. And to the extent that I was taught anything, I was taught that, you know, Robert E. Lee was an honorable man who fought for the state and the people that he loved. I was taught that the Civil War was about states' rights and that it was reflective of a failure to compromise when, in fact, you know, all that had been happening in the decades prior to the Civil War were attempts to compromise. And what was compromised was the freedom of enslaved people. And so part of what made me want to write this book was that, like, I remember growing up in New Orleans and being inundated with these messages, some implicit, some explicit, about why New Orleans was the way that it was, right? I was, you know, we're inundated with messages that New Orleans was the murder capital of the nation, that we incarcerated more people per capita than China and Iran and Russia, that there was a sort of culture of violence, a culture of a pathology that was so deeply embedded in the city. And implicit within that is the black people within the city, because this was, for especially at that time, for a long time, a majority black city. And so I was inundated with these messages as a child and as a young person, and I felt like I didn't have the language or the toolkit or the framework with which to push back against it. What happens is you almost experience sort of psychological and emotional paralysis where you like know that the things that this country is telling you about your community and about people who look like you is wrong, but you don't necessarily have the language or the history with which to explain it.
So it's very hard to change the narrative of history, even when the narrative you're trying to change is proven to be wrong or distorted. But some places really are trying to change the narrative, and you visited one of those places, Jefferson's home and plantation, Monticello. And it seems that the narrative there is changing, that the tours given to people now are saying very different things about the history there than the tours that used to be given. Give us an example of that.
Yeah, so Monticello, I think, is a really fascinating example of a place that evolves and changes over time and responds to new information and shapes the curation of their museum experience in that way. And so one example of a new project that they've begun is something that started a few years ago, which is a tour that focuses on the Hemingses of Monticello, the Hemings family. And the Hemings family was an enslaved family, an enslaved black family on Monticello's plantation, which included Sally Hemings, who was the daughter of Elizabeth Hemings and John Wales. So her father was a white man and her mother was a mixed race black woman. And so she was actually a quarter black, but was still enslaved on that plantation because of the sort of notions of the one drop rule and that one drop of African blood would make you black, which, you know, gets into a larger thing of race as a social construction. But regardless, the Hemingses were enslaved on this plantation and were really central to what the plantation was and how it operated. And part of what Monticello has recognized is that they have to center the lives of the enslaved people who lived there and not just center the story of Monticello on Jefferson, because it's much larger than Jefferson. And in order to understand it as a plantation, we have to understand the people who lived on that plantation and made it what it was outside of the context of this single man.
I thought it was really interesting that some of the tourists are basically prepared, or you might even say warned, by the tour guides that some of what you're going to hear today might be difficult. Because a lot of the people who come to visit Monticello are just expecting a heroic story about Jefferson and not realizing that some of the story they're going to get is about Jefferson as a slave owner, somebody who bought and sold people and who had a sexual relationship with one of the people who he owned. So did that surprise you that they were almost like, you know, like warnings before the tour?
It did. So the tour you're referencing is the Slavery at Monticello tour. And one of the things that was most interesting about it is that, to your point, a lot of people come to this place having no conception of Jefferson as someone who owned enslaved people. And so I spoke to these two women after my tour, Donna and Grace, and I had been watching them during the tour given by this man, David Thurston, who's a tour guide at Monticello. And he talked about slavery and Jefferson and Jefferson's relationship to slavery in ways that were more direct than any teacher I had ever had. And it was clearly deeply impacting these women, and their mouths were agape and they were clearly sort of unnerved and unsettled. And I went up to them afterwards and spoke to them, and they were just like, I had no idea Jefferson owned slaves. I had no idea that Monticello was a plantation. And mind you, these are people who bought plane tickets, who bought hotel rooms, who rented cars to come to this place almost as a pilgrimage to see the home of the third president of the United States, one of our founding fathers, but had no conception of him as someone who enslaved human beings.
Yeah, and getting back to Sally Hemings for a second, she was 16 and Jefferson was in his mid-40s when he started his sexual relationship with her. So he's having sex with somebody who he owns, and she's 16.
Right. Part of what Monticello is doing, too, is trying to sort of complicate notions of the history that we've been taught and saying that, you know, we cannot understand what Sally Hemings' relationship to Jefferson was as something that was fully consensual because he owned her. And that is should serve as an entry point to us thinking about the way that Black women throughout the history of slavery were treated, the way that their bodies in so many ways were not their own, and the ways that they were subjected to rape and to assault and to just an onslaught of subjugation to their bodies in ways that I don't think this country has fully accounted for.
So when you think about the Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson was one of the drafters of the Declaration, what do you have to reconcile in your mind?
I mean, Jefferson, I think, generally is such a fascinating historical figure for me because I think he is sort of a microcosm of America. He's a microcosm of the dissonance and the disconnect and the contradictions of this country in the sense that America is this place that has provided unimaginable, unparalleled opportunities for millions of people across generations to build wealth and create opportunities for upward mobility, and has done so at the direct expense of millions and millions of other people who have been subjugated and oppressed across generations. And the story of America is both of those things. And we have to hold both of those things at once to recognize the totality and complexity of this country. And I think Jefferson, similarly, you know, is the man who wrote one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world and is also someone who enslaved over 600 people over the course of his lifetime, including four of his own children. He is someone who wrote in one document that all men are created equal and wrote in another document that Black people are inferior to whites in both endowments of body and mind. And so I think that Monticello and Jefferson, and one of the reasons I wanted to go there for this book, is that I wanted to explore how this place tells a fuller, more honest, robust story of this person so that we can have a fuller, more honest, more robust understanding of this country that he was one of the creators of.
In the epilogue of your book, you write about your grandparents. And you actually interview them. And so I'd like to start this section of our interview with asking you to read a paragraph about your grandfather's grandfather. And to me, this is almost like a prose poem.
I'd be happy to. My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. They shared a name, a lineage, and the hard soil of Mississippi, My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. I thought about how I felt pulled closer to the center of the concentric circle of history. My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. I said it out loud and let it idle on the edges of my lips. My family told me that my grandfather's grandfather was born into slavery, and I never knew until I asked.
When did you ask?
It was in the process of writing this book. One of the reasons I wanted to end the book with the interviews and conversations with my grandparents is based on a trip that I took with my grandparents to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And we were walking through the museum. I was pushing my grandfather in his wheelchair, and my grandmother was walking a little bit in front of us. And I had this moment where I was walking through this museum, and I realized that so much of the violence and history that was documented in this museum was something that they had experienced firsthand. You know, my grandfather born in 1930, Jim Crow apartheid, Mississippi. My grandmother born in 1939, Jim Crow apartheid, Florida. You know, this history, the history that we are made to feel happened in the Jurassic Age almost, is something that they lived through. And when I spoke to my grandmother, she had this refrain. You know, when I asked her about our trip to the museum, she was just like, "I lived it. I lived it. I lived it." Like, she was looking around and realizing that, like, so much of what she was seeing, she lived through it and experienced it directly. And I just really, you know, I'd spent these years working on this book, interviewing strangers and going into the archives and thinking about primary source documents and asking people I had just met their life story and what their relationship to the history of slavery was. And I realized I had never been as intentional in doing so with my own family. And so I sat down and had this series of conversations with my grandparents and just learned so much about them and their history and their own lineage, which is my own, in ways that I never would have known otherwise.
You know, the reading that you did for us, it's almost like you just mulling over and saying to yourself over and over, my grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. And I'm sure, like, you knew in some abstract level that your ancestors had been enslaved. What was the difference between knowing abstractly and finding out that your grandfather's grandfather was enslaved? Like, because it sounds like it was almost, in its own way, a shock to have the specificity of that.
Yeah, I think it gave me a different sense of my proximity to that history. Again, because, you know, as I sort of mentioned, like, we are taught that the history of slavery is something that happened, you know, almost like when there were dinosaurs. It was like the dinosaurs, the Flintstones, and slavery. You know, like, in so many ways, that's how young people are taught to think about it. They are taught to think that this is something that was terrible, but was a long, 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 long time ago. And when I encounter information that's like, my grandfather's grandfather was enslaved, you know, this person who I love, this person who I was raised around, this person who is so central to my life and my own identity, is someone who was only a generation or two removed from a family member who had been born into slavery. And so I think about my own 4-year-old son sitting on my grandfather's lap. And I imagine what it would have been like for my grandfather to sit on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded that this history that we are told was so long ago wasn't in fact that long ago at all. The woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture alongside the Obama family in 2016, who rang the bell to sort of signal the opening of this museum, was the daughter of an enslaved person. Not the granddaughter, not the great-great-granddaughter, but like was the daughter of someone who had been born into slavery. And this is in 2016. And so it's a reminder that there are people still alive today who loved, who were raised by, who knew, who were in community with people who had been born into chattel slavery. And I think when you realize our proximity to that, you gain a different understanding of how the idea that what our society and what our country looks like today would not be impacted by that is both morally and intellectually disingenuous.
Clint Smith, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Terry.
Clint Smith's new book is called How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering today from Al Banks. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.